This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Or as they say in South Africa, Sonibono, which means it's hello, goodbye, but literally it means I see you, which I think is wonderful. That I think is partly what we miss. If we don't feel seen. So in that language, you are always being seen. So first of all, how many of you are here for the first time? Okay, quite a few. So when we were reciting that sutra during the service, the Heart Sutra, it takes years and years to understand it. So please do not worry if you thought it was very cryptic. It's actually the very, very, very shortened version of an extremely long document, sort of like the Cliff's Notes for sutras. And so when it's saying all those no eyes, no ears, no nose, and all of that stuff, it's not saying that you don't have them. Of course you have them. You have to insert the words, no permanent and abiding nature of eyes, no permanent and abiding nature of all the other things that were listed. It's just pointing always to the emptiness, the all changing that is happening all the time. So the you that arrived this morning has already been here for an hour or so, and you're different. There's a new you here. So welcome. And today I wanted to talk about sanctuary. This is both something that's very relevant right now in the news, but it also has to do with the fact that I just returned from the trip of a lifetime. I went to South Africa for 2 weeks as an environmental volunteer, and we kept thinking that they should be working us harder because the work they gave us was really very easy. And then they were taking us to all these wonderful game parks that had the most amazing animals and birds and flora. It's just, if there is ever a chance in your life to go, please do. It's the parks themselves are the way that this country used to be in its early days. Vast expanses of just grasslands and wild animals. So I was very fortunate to be able to do this with one of my oldest friends that I started meditation practice with 40 years ago, who happens to be a wildlife biologist, and her two daughters, who I taught in what we called Dharma school. So I kind of helped raise them a little. So the four of us went, and it began, and all three of them are wildlife biologists. I have a degree in biology, but I've been a teacher, a school teacher for, or was anyway, for 33 years. So all of that stuff about field research and data collection and bio blitzing, as they call, was new to me. So not only did I get to see this incredible land, but I learned a lot. Anyway, it turned out that my friend is in Tassajara right now, which, if you know, is the teaching monastery for Zen practice, and especially for San Francisco Zen Center, which I am in the lineage of. But I share a lineage with this group here because my teacher's teacher was also Koben Shino Roshi. So I sort of have a dual connection. Anyway, my friend Diane is in Tassajara right at the moment with the guiding teacher there and one of the indigenous local heroes, Little Bear. And they decided that the theme of their workshop this week was going to be about sanctuary. And so, but Diane and I had lots of conversations about the meaning of sanctuary simply because when you go to a game park, that's what it is. It's a sanctuary for animals. So what do we mean by the word sanctuary? Well, it's a place of safety. It's a place of refuge. You know, not only in this country, but in Europe, a lot of places, if you could make it to a church, you could claim sanctuary. And as long as you were in that church, Nobody could touch you. Not the government, not other religions. So we have a long history of having sanctuary. And sanctuary is often associated with a place, a temple or a church, and a game preserve, which I came to realize. And for Buddhists, for those of you who have not been here very much, every single ceremony we do has a time of taking refuge, of seeking sanctuary in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, which are the three treasures. And this is because we understand that sanctuary is not necessarily a place. Sanctuary is pretty much in here. So this is part of what I'm going to talk about is the sanctuary of our own heart, of our heart, mind, our shin. Because sometimes sanctuary does not exist out there. We can't always rely on religious practices or government institutions to protect us. So we end up relying on ourselves. And the best example of this is that many of the people who went through the Nazi concentration camps, when they were interviewed later, the ones who survived, they were asked, how did you do that? With everyone around you being either sent on death marches or being sent to the gas ovens, how did you do that? Because they went inside. They also went outside helping everyone else that they could. They became sanctuary itself. So the case, there are many, you've probably heard of koan, and there are many books containing all these koan and teaching stories. There's one that's called the Book of Serenity. And case four, story four, is called The World Honored One Points to the Ground. The World Honored One, of course, in this case, is the Buddha. So this is supposedly taking place in his lifetime. So here's how it goes. As the World Honored One was walking with his congregation, he pointed to the ground with his finger and said, "This spot is good to build a sanctuary." Indra, emperor of the gods who was with him, took a blade of grass, stuck it in the ground, and said, "The sanctuary is built." The World Honored One smiled. Now you're sitting there thinking, what? A blade of grass? This is not about an external sanctuary. The Buddha points to a random spot on the ground. It doesn't actually matter. And he declares that it's a good place for sanctuary, a good place to take refuge. And Indra immediately understands what he's talking about. So he picks a blade of grass and he sticks it in the ground, saying the sanctuary is built. But he just as easily could have picked up a feather or a rock or a shoe and placed it there and said the same thing. All he was doing, all Indra was doing, was acknowledging his understanding of the Buddha's great teaching. Sanctuary is where you are. It is not outside of yourself. You can always rely upon it that way. So when I went to South Africa, I had no idea what I was getting myself in for. I had sort of had my arm twisted, but not very hard, to go on this trip with my old friend. She had been on it once before last September and came back and decided both of her daughters needed to go. And then they came and lobbied me, which is really sweet. But I told them at the time, I said, my only real hesitation is I haven't practiced biological research techniques since college. I'm going to be 70 very soon. So you can imagine college is a long time ago. And they said, oh, don't worry about that. We're gonna do it with you. We'll bring you along. I was like, okay. So I didn't understand that I was going to be doing field research, that we were going to be measuring every 2 meters of this new piece of land that this group, Wild Tomorrow, had just bought. The reason that we were doing this, there is a big game preserve on one side called Pindi. And then over here, there is another game preserve called Ukwela Imfolosi. In between, there's a narrow piece of which this group, Wild Tomorrow, owns probably three quarters now. Because what they're trying to do is create a land bridge between the two preserves. But in order to do that, you have to do it in certain ways. Because, for instance, elephants can come through the land bridge and destroy everything so that there's nothing there for the other animals to eat. I mean, they literally knock trees down and then completely eat everything. So there have to be some fences for the elephants sort of to be on one side and the other animals can be on the other side of that fence in order that the land bridge works for everyone. So we were out there investigating this new piece of property they just bought, trying to figure out what kind of grasses there were, native grasses, checking out the local wildlife, checking out the birds, and I don't have very great eyesight. And my three friends all had these fabulous binoculars, and mine were pitiful. So that was a little bit of a learning experience for me. They'd say, "Oh, look at that bird." And I was like, "Where?" But eventually, they just handed me their binoculars and they told me where to look. The birds in South Africa are amazing. I think I had identified six birds in my backyard before I went. There's an app called the Merlin from Cornell University. By the time I got home, I had 60 birds on my list, many of them life birds that people spend their whole life waiting to see. And there they were. They were like just in front of us. On one day, we were actually catching some of the birds in these particularly safe nets, handling them to band them. And then that way we can keep track of them. So I was doing the recording, and they measure the beak, they measure the head, they measure the tail, they measure how many new feathers there are, whether the bird is breeding. And the birds, oh my goodness. There's one bird that has what's called a wattle around its eye. So it sits out a little bit from the eye. And this is because this bird goes into the cobwebs deliberately, rubs its head around in them, takes them back to its nest, and with its claw, I guess, gets the web into its nest. So it's a nest-making material. But if it weren't for the wattle, of course, it would get into its eye. Nature is amazing. Anyway, so there I am in South Africa with this nonprofit group doing some of this volunteer work, but also being taken around to many game parks, including one that was on a river for hippos. And I pretty much saw all the big five. So giraffe, lions, cheetahs, hippos. Oh, I'm trying to think of the other one.
Elephants.
Elephants, thank you. I knew there was one missing. But then we also got to see zebras and ostrich and the two lions we saw, though, that was at night, they were 5 feet off the road, two males, lying there as if dead to the world. They had obviously had a lot to eit. And I mean, it was crazy. The game park guys are shining the lights so that we can see them. I'm thinking any moment they're going to get up and come and eat us. Not a bit of it. They were so full. The one bigger lion kind of at one point went, went back to sleep. So the cheetahs were much more active, and they are amazing creatures, just so graceful. And then there's the giraffe, which is a totally improbable creature. And a lot of times, the first thing you would see would be their head 50 feet above the tree. They have a forked tongue. Hippos, we had to go to this river. But while on the river, there were all of these wonderful river birds, including what was called the Goliath heron. It stands this tall. It's as big as heron I've ever seen. It was beautiful. It has a wingspan of 5 meters. That's big. So it was such a privilege to be able to see all of this. But what I was realizing all the way along was, I know that these are all animals that are being poached for various reasons. The rhinos, black and white, are almost extinct because poachers, when you've got a game park that's thousands of hectares, what they do is they create a disturbance on one side while their compatriots are on the other side breaking in. And the only reason they want the rhino is for its horn. So often they will shoot the rhino, but not kill it. And then they come in with their chainsaw to take the horns, because there are people in other cultures who believe those horns have aphrodisiacal properties. They leave the animal to die in pain. Now, I'm trying not to be very judgmental because, of course, we did the same thing. Years and years ago, there were hundreds of thousands of bison. And the early pioneer traders would come, shoot them, take their pelts and their tongues, and leave the rest of it in the sun to waste. For the indigenous people, this was inexplicable. So it isn't just these South Africans. It's this mindset of humans that animals are less important. So game parks, of course, were created as a sanctuary for these wild animals, so that someday your children and your children's children will actually be able to still see a giraffe or a rhino or a cheetah. Because here's the difficulty. Even though we will have these animals in zoos, they don't reproduce well in zoos. So eventually, there won't be any rhinos. There won't be any giraffe. It'll be a story, a bedtime story. You'll show a picture, but those children will not actually have ever seen one. So it's really important to protect them now while we can. So the way that they protect the rhino sounds a little weird at first, but this vet, who's probably my age, has been doing this for years and years. They have perfected a sedative that gets shot from a rifle from a helicopter. They find the rhino that they're looking for. The vet is a marksman, a sharpshooter, and he shoots the dart into the rear of the creature. Now, a rhino has skin this thick, plus a layer of fat. So it's got to be a pretty powerful shot to make it in. They have been perfecting this sedative for over 15 years because it is a form of morphine only 10,000 times stronger than what you and I would be doing, because it's a 2-ton creature. But they have a protocol. Once the animal has been shot, the helicopter lands, people like me are 150 feet away. All the game rangers now rush in once the animal falls over, and they stand there for a couple minutes, and then it's just. They check to see that it's fallen in a comfortable position, which in this case, it was not perfectly. So all the rangers, which are big guys, get on one side and they push the rhino until they can rearrange its legs. They don't want to stress the animal. So the very first thing they do is they blindfold it and they put these enormous earplugs. Now the vet comes along. He's got his chainsaw. He explained all this to us up front. The chainsaw, the horn is nothing more than the same stuff that your nails are made out of. This particular rhino had been rescued years ago as an orphan and then rewilded. So it had been about 4 years since they had seen this rhino again to do this. They cut off as close as they can the rhino horn. There's two of them, one big one and one small one, as close as they can with a chainsaw while the animal is completely sedated. And when we asked, well, doesn't that hurt? He said, well, think about it. When you go to the dentist and your mouth is completely, no feeling. You still feel pressure. You might feel vibration. You might hear something, but you don't feel pain. It's the same concept. So they use a chainsaw rather than a Sawzall because the chainsaw doesn't create much heat, whereas a Sawzall would. It takes 2 seconds. Then he comes in with a round sander and bevels the edges to make them nice and smooth because we know it's going to grow back. This is just like your nails. It will grow back. But what it does is it protects the rhino because no poacher in their right mind is going to be taking any time with a rhino with no horn. So while they would prefer to do it other ways, there is no other way that works. There can't be enough rangers. You'd have to have hundreds of rangers 50 feet apart because they always come at night. And as I say, they often create a distraction in one part of the park and they're actually doing something in the other part. So years ago, when I was still the librarian at Peninsula School, I had read a book to my seven-year-olds every year called Walter Warthog. This is a true story of a place called Giraffe Manor, which is in Zimbabwe outside of Nairobi. And these people were trying to save the Rothschild giraffe, which is a very particular one, which was being poached only for its tail. They would use the tail to make bracelets. The rest of the animal, not interested. So what happens in the story, Walter Warthog plays a big part because they find out that the warthogs are really very friendly. I mean, they're like very intelligent pigs. Unfortunately for them, they also taste like pig. And so they're often being poached as well. So this family befriends this warthog and he gets himself in a snare. And after 3 days of pulling at it, so it's cutting into his skin, but he can't eat, he can't drink. He finally breaks the wire and he comes to the family and they take it off. And the local wild animal vet is amazed because Walter doesn't charge them. Instead, he starts to run towards the son who's taken it off. And instead of charging, he slows down, comes up and rubs up against him as if to say, thank you. So I read this to the kids, partly because I want them to understand about poaching. But at the end, the most amazing thing is they have some people in from Nairobi cleaning their house. When one of the women comes running out, the biggest dog I have ever seen is chasing me. It was one of the giraffes sticking its head in the second floor window. When we think of Africa, we think of giraffe, an elephant, and cheetah. But if you are a local, you can't go to the game park unless you're in a car. You are not allowed out of your vehicle. My experience in South Africa is almost no one has a car. They walk miles. We're coming home, it's 10 o'clock at night, it's pitch black, and people are walking along the dirt road as you and I would walk in Palo Alto. It's stunning. So if you don't have a car, you don't get in. So then you have to find a friend who does have a car, and then it costs money. So if you're poor, you don't ever get to see your own animals. This is nuts. So what this family decided to do was they started bringing 3,000 children out every month to come and visit the giraffe, the warthogs, their horses. And that is the beginning to be aware. We know that from our practice. Awareness of something is the beginning of change. So without sanctuary, these animals aren't going to survive. Rhinos, as I say, are almost hunted to extinction. And every time they have to do a dehorning, it's about $5,000 American dollars. Well, if you have 1,000 rhinos, that's a lot of money. So the good news is this volunteer program, $2,000 of my fee, was tax deductible because they give it to the rhino dehorning people. So you can also feel really good about being there, that you're doing something useful. Okay, so this is about the animals, and that's wonderful, but what about people? What about sanctuary for human beings? As I said earlier, traditionally, temples, churches, have been sanctuary for those who are seeking asylum, either from religious or political persecution. So here I am in South Africa, and I'm trying not to look at my news very much because most of it's bad. And I start reading about these individuals who are being picked up by ICE and being shipped off. No due process, no court representation, no phone call. They're just grabbed and sent off to places like El Salvador. This is not the country I grew up in. This could not have happened here 50 years ago. It's scary because it means it could happen to any of us. I was talking to a friend yesterday who's Persian. He's here on a green card. He's lived in this country for 15 years. He has married a citizen, and he's still scared. He's afraid that maybe he's speeding a few miles over the speed limit and he gets pulled over. Maybe because of the way he looks or his name, he gets whisked away. And he told me this, and I said, okay, yeah, you have a right to be scared. You need to be extra, extra careful. But please know, if something happens to you, every member of your Sangha and my Sangha, we're going to be there. This isn't going to happen in silence. This is our job to provide the sanctuary of the heart for anyone who is not rightfully given their due process. This is the part I don't understand. This is in our Constitution. Everyone is allowed their day in court. It doesn't matter if you know they're guilty. I was on a trial years ago. They already knew this man was guilty of killing an 8-year-old girl after raping her. They had all the facts, but he had his day in court. In fact, he had his 6 weeks in court. I had to look at terrible photographs. But he got his day in court. This is one of our inalienable rights in this country. The rule of law itself is a form of sanctuary. When the first non-Indigenous people came to this country, why were they coming? To get away from religious persecution. Because where they were coming from said, no, you can't practice that religion. So we as Buddhists, there's a big move to make this country totally Christian-based, to stop church and state being separate. The whole reason this all works in this country is that church and state are separate. Nobody's saying you can't worship whatever way you want to. What we're saying is we want to be able to have the choice. That is very slowly but surely being taken away. So right now we have these individuals being deported to terrible places. Not because they did anything wrong. There are some people who would like to say, oh, they're murderers, they're rapists. No, the most recent one is a Buddhist chaplain from Colombia. And because he is not a white man, he got picked up on his way to what he thought he was going to his final interview for citizenship. And instead, ICE just came along and whisked him away. Well, the good news is there's a whole group of American Zen teachers who have signed a petition to say, you need to release this guy right away. And we've sent it to his lawyers. And you might think to yourself, well, what's a letter? I agree. It's a small thing. But we may all be being asked to do small things. To stand up for each other, to be each other's sangha. We just don't know where this is going. So if you're feeling a little distressed about all of this, or maybe a little anxious, you have a right to feel that way. It is a bit of a scary time. So what can we do with those feelings? Let's return to the Buddha, pointing to the ground and saying, this spot is a good place to build a sanctuary. I'm sure that when Kōbun Shinō Roshi saw this land years ago, because my teacher was part of that group, that's exactly what was in his heart. Ah, this is a good place to build a temple. This is good land. And many people agreed, and so money was raised to buy this land. And many people have given their blood, sweat, and tears to do this beautiful thing that you are visiting today. Indra takes a blade of grass, sticks it in the ground, and says, the sanctuary is built. Well, I think building Jikoji took a little bit more than a blade of grass. And it is continuing to need lots of help and work and support. But it's still here. You know, this happened in the 60s. It's still here and it's thriving because of all of you. Because we are all in this together. All of our hearts are here together. So in the introduction to this case, there's a question that gets asked. Who is this person who can be master in any place and meet the source in everything? Sanctuary can be a specific place. It can be Jikoji. It can be Tassajara. It could be your local temple, your local church. It could be a government, which this government has been in the past. You know, the Statue of Liberty sitting out there outside of Manhattan. Bring me your poor. Bring me your desperate. Bring me your individuals who want freedom. We have always encouraged asylum and refugees in this country. We are a country of immigrants. It just depends on how far you have to go back, right? In my case, I have to go back, let's see, four generations to those who came from England and Germany. For some people, it's one generation. It doesn't really matter. We all came, except for the indigenous people, we have all come from somewhere else. And we were welcomed and embraced. So unfortunately, external sanctuary is not always available to us. There's a wonderful story, though, a true story about a Tibetan Lama. At the time that Tibetans, including the Dalai Lama, had to escape from their own country because of the Chinese invasion, this Tibetan Lama was taken into custody against his will, obviously, just for being Tibetan. And he was tortured for years and years. Finally, he was released. And at that time, people all said, how did you do this? How did you do it without hating the Chinese? And he said, well, the practice is to let go of hate, because I knew that if I allowed it to take me over, I would lose myself. And so he continued to practice compassion for the very people who were torturing him. I think about this right now because there's a few people I wouldn't mind hanging up by their toes, but I can't do it. It's not our practice. Our practice is to understand that delusion is powerful. And that if we believe that people are behaving badly and being cruel, it is because they are in an extreme state of delusion. And all of us have been in delusion at times, I'm sure. So we can understand that. So then, where is sanctuary actually to be found? We talk about there being a relative world and the absolute world. In the relative world, this is when you get in your car and you have to pay attention to laws like not going through red lights, right? In the absolute realm, everything is just as it is. Neither good nor bad, up, down, it's just what it is. So in the relative, ordinary world, we may find ourselves without the sanctuary of law, without the sanctuary of government, without the support. We might even not have the support of our neighbors. We are in a time, an unprecedented amount of partisanship. People are afraid to even say what they think because someone else might get mad and pull a gun. This seems to be the new thing. I don't like you. I don't agree with you. This is craziness. We have forgotten how to agree to disagree. I'm not asking everyone to agree with me. And in fact, I'm very interested to hear why you might feel differently, because maybe I'm missing something. But we're moving away from that. It's my way or the highway now. And that's not helpful. It just creates more of a separation, more of a separate self. But in the absolute world of emptiness, that thing I talked about at the beginning, no permanent abiding nature of anything. Most of you are pretty young in this group, but I guarantee you will be 70 one day if you're lucky, if nothing happens to you. You are getting older by the second. Your body is changing by the second. I hope your mind also changes by the second. There is nothing you can point at that is going to stay the same. This gives us a certain amount of pause because we're like, oh God, I'm always on shifting sands. Yes, but the good news is, even the difficult things, this too shall pass. Everything changes. It's the fundamental truth. So we have to find sanctuary then in our understanding of that, of the fundamental interdependence of everything. Right now, this group right here, you are all breathing the same air in and out. So the person next to you is breathing your air, and the person on the other side is breathing your air. When does it become your air? Right? When it's already inside of you, or when it's on your lips? And when it comes back out, when does it stop being your air? There is no such thing as yours or mine. It's just air, but we're all sharing it. As we are all sharing the sound of my voice at this point, as we are all sharing our desire to be here, whatever the reason for that was. And the impermanence of everything. And what we hope is not too much harm is done as things are changing. Because I will tell you, absolutely, the most fundamental core teaching of Buddhism is cause no harm. Now, of course, this is impossible. If you drove here in a car today, you killed a lot of insects. And you might think, oh, well, they're just insects. But insects are sentient beings too. And a lot of them are pretty important because they do things like pollination and digging in the ground. Turns out termite mounds in South Africa is a sign of well-being for the land. So we can't just dismiss things like that. So then, really, what I've said for myself is cause the least amount of harm possible, which is a slightly different thing. Sanctuary is inside each of you and me. It cannot be taken away from you, no matter what they do to you on the outside. They cannot take away your true self. My spiritual grandfather, Suzuki Roshi, used to talk a lot about finding your true home. So many of us, when we first came to practice and we walked into the Zendo, I remember that day crystal clear of, ah, why does this look so familiar to me? I'd never been in a Zendo before. I had never seen all these grass tatami mats or the square zabutons and zafus. But the moment I walked in, it was like, ah, home. I'm home. I don't know what that was. I think it's a feeling of sanctuary. I think it is a feeling of safety. I'm finally this place that is going to support my inner sanctuary, and that is called Sangha. Sangha is the community of practice people that supports each other. So this is the person who can master in any place and meet the source in everything. That person is you. That person is the person who draws on the sanctuary in here. And I wish you all very well, and thank you so much for coming today. So I don't know what the timing is here. Sokyo-san.
Yeah, is it time? We have like 10 minutes.
Oh, okay.
For a question.
So if anyone would like to add a comment or ask a question, now is a really good time. Oh, yes.
Why do we bow to the Buddha when he didn't want to be a god?
We're not bowing to the Buddha. That's the easy answer. I know it looks like that's what we're doing. The statue of the Buddha, he didn't want statues of himself either, right? In the beginning, all there was on an altar was a sandal indicating that we, at the beginning, we talked about the Tathagata, right? The Tathagata just means the one who has thus come. And that's the Buddha because he comes without any ego. He comes without any sense of small self, right? He arrives completely formed. But we have these statues to remind us of the Buddha here. You are Buddha. The ground is Buddha. Statue is Buddha. The flowers are Buddha. I've been thinking recently that if I was ever called to give testimony, you know, they always bring out the Bible. Well, I don't use a Bible. So there are other things that they can use. But if I was ever asked, do you believe in God? I would have to clarify. What do you mean by God? Because what I mean by it is everything. There isn't anything that isn't God. There isn't anything that isn't Buddha. So we bow. We are bowing to ourselves and this true home inside of us, as well as bowing to each other. Thank you for being here today. It's just a reminder. Buddha was a great teacher, but you're right, he did not want to be a god. And that is actually one of my main disagreements with other religions. I don't think Jesus wanted to be a god either. You know, I think he was an incredibly enlightened, kind, caring person. And his message got diluted. Some or deluded somewhere along the way, because his main message was to take care of each other, to love others as you would like to be loved yourself. And I do not see that happening a lot in the Christian community. I see a lot of partisanship and a lot of my way or the highway. So we do a lot of bowing. We bow to our cushion to say, thank you, cushion, for being here. I really appreciate that. We bow to each other of thank you so much for coming today. Because we understand that we're all this. If we think of we're bowing to Buddha, we have just separated, right? If we think that we are bowing to everything, it all comes back together. I think that's a wonderful question. Thank you. You don't have to ask a question about what I talked about either. You can ask anything you want. So.
So in Sanskrit, dharma has like two connotations. It could either mean duty or, you know, righteousness, sacred path. What does dharma mean when we talk about dharma?
Oh boy. There's lots of definitions of dharma. I think there's like 60 different definitions, but
yeah, I mentioned two because that's what I'm
using. That's what you're familiar with. Well, so we talk about the three treasures: Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And the way that's usually talked about is Buddha as the perfect teacher, Dharma as the perfect teaching, and Sangha as the perfect community of practitioners. So there's Dharma with a big D, which contains all the teachings, right? Then there's the little dharmas, which is everything is a dharma. Sitting on our cushion is a dharma. Speaking, you know, giving a talk is a dharma. Drinking a cup of tea with mindfulness is a dharma. So for us, I think part of the difficulty is translation, that, you know, because we're always struggling with the Sanskrit, the Pali, the Japanese, the Chinese, and most of us don't speak those languages. So Dharma as the perfect teaching. The perfect teaching is about emptiness. It's about the fact that everything is connected. When I hate the word emptiness because it gives the wrong idea. It makes it sound like we're nihilistic. We are not. Emptiness is actually that everything is empty of a permanent, abiding nature. When you finally see that, what you realize is, in this room, it's as if we're looking through an electron microscope. If this room, if all of you were in the area of the sight of the electron microscope, what you would be seeing is atoms closely together, creating something that's vaguely human-shaped, and lots of molecules going off in all directions as you are evaporating, right? It's kind of like if you've seen the movie The Matrix. It's sort of like that. Everything in The Matrix is actually connected, right? But it is true. These guys knew this 2,500 years ago simply by sitting down in meditation, whereas science, it took it a while to catch up. But you think this hand is solid. This hand is not solid. This hand has molecules coming off it, and they're meeting molecules in the air. So if you could see it through the electron microscope, it would look like this wave was happening. But even more than that, beyond atoms and molecules, we're all here in the same room. Isn't that kind of amazing? So there's a saying in Japanese, Ichigo, or Ichie, Ichigo. One meeting, one time. It will never be like this again. It will never be this group of people with the mindset that you brought with you today, the weather that we have, the birds that are singing, the bells that are ringing, the incense that is smoking. It will never, ever be exactly the same. So we understand that, and we behave from that place of, this moment is so precious because it will never come again. And I will just tell you that the older you get, the faster it goes. When we were little kids, the summer seemed to last forever. It's like, when am I going back to school? By the time you got to be in your 20s, you know, you were finishing up college, you were thinking about a job and all of that. It sped up a little bit. Summers were not the time off that you used to have. By the time you get to the end of your occupation and you're going into retirement and taking up new things that occupy you, it's going by pretty fast. I am now on the other side Right? All those years I was thinking, oh, middle age, 50, oh, it's way out there. Oh, it comes a lot faster than you think. And I'm one of the fortunate ones because I'm still alive. I have all these people that I know who died early. They didn't want to die. A lot of them got cancer. Some of them got brain tumors. One of my little 12-year-olds at school, that was my first experience of hospice, she got a brain tumor and she was dead 2 years later. She didn't even get to be an adult. But here we are. This is this moment right here and now. Whatever you're doing is so precious. Please don't take it for granted. That is the great Dharma teaching. Be here now and appreciate it, even when it's really miserable, even when it's hard and it's scary, because something is happening in that moment to pay attention to. Awareness. Thank you. So I think that's probably it for time.
Page two.
Okay. Delusions are inexhaustible. I belong to them. The gates are downsized. I want to enter them. But this way is unsurpassable.
If we give Bruno our cushions back now and just stand behind them.